Today is Wednesday, May 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump is doubling down on his decision to take a controversial drug.
There's little known about the drug's effectiveness in battling the coronavirus, but it could have serious side effects, including heart problems.
Plus, Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen vowed to step up defense against Beijing and new research in the fight against malaria.
It might be possible to get populations up to the level where the mosquitoes are no longer posing any risk to us.
Those stories and more coming up next. U.S. President Donald Trump is doubling down on his decision to take a controversial drug despite scant evidence that the anti-malaria drug is effective at preventing infection or cures patients with the coronavirus. On another front, the president is pushing forward with his threat to permanently withdraw funding from the World Health Organization. White House correspondent Patsy Wittig-Aswara starts us off.
President Donald Trump, who reportedly has tested negative for the coronavirus, defended his decision to take hydroxychloroquine. He said he has been taking it for the past 2 weeks and dismissed an unnamed survey about the drug.
If you look at the one survey, the only bad survey, they were giving it to people that were in very bad shape. They were very old, almost dead. It was a Trump enemy statement.
There's little known about the drug's effectiveness in battling the coronavirus, but it could have serious side effects, including heart problems. David Sullivan is a professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
I would not recommend people just taking it to try to prevent them getting the virus at the present time, because the risks do outweigh the benefits if you're just trying to take it for prevention, unless you're in a randomized clinical trial where you can find the answer.
In the middle of the drug dust-up, President Trump is also pushing ahead with his threat to permanently cut off funding for the World Health Organization, accusing the WHO of allowing China to cover up its part in the coronavirus outbreak.
Basically, they have to clean up their act. They have to do a better job. They have to be much more fair to other countries, including the United States.
As U.S. criticism mounted, WHO member states agreed to an independent probe into the U.N.'s agency's coronavirus response. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
WHO remains fully committed to transparency, accountability, and continuous improvement.
Trump declined to speak at the assembly where Xi Jinping addressed WHO members. The Chinese president said he supported an investigation, but said it should wait until the pandemic is contained. He also announced China will provide $2 billion to help with the COVID-19 response in developing countries. Robert Daly is the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
China is now working with the rest of the WHO as a member, and it can use that inside the tent status and its professed willingness, I think you can question its sincerity, to be part of the investigation. I think we can expect to see China use that insider status to slow walk and limit the investigation going forward, whereas the United States increasingly is placing itself outside of that process.
The U.S. supported the WHO resolution, but objected the call for universal, timely, and equitable access to vaccines, saying the language used would send the wrong message to innovators concerned about intellectual property. Patsy Wittig-Aswara, VOA News, Washington.
In New York City, the rate of new cases of COVID-19 has slowed, but the struggle of health workers to save the thousands of patients infected with the virus continues. Because COVID-19 attacks the lungs, pulmonary specialists of all types are especially needed in the fight. For the next part of our ongoing series of interviews with frontline healthcare workers, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Zoom with Sydney Vaness, a respiratory therapist who left her family in New Jersey over a month ago to serve in a teeming Brooklyn hospital.
I'm working in a crisis response unit with the nurses and physicians to try to keep as many people alive as possible. There's a lot going on.
Now, do you intubate patients yourself? Just to explain to our listeners, intubation is putting a breathing tube down somebody's mouth, down their throat, into the lungs to force them to breathe.
No. In this particular hospital, we manage the vents. We watch the waveforms. We have to follow their blood work. We have to know their pre-existing health condition. You have to look at the telemonitors. We work with the nurse if they need more sedation. You really have to know your whole patient to manage events successfully.
It was late March, early April, when the extent of the catastrophe was really becoming clear. What was the scene like at work in those days?
First, it was one patient to a room. Then it was two patients to a room. There's patients on stretchers everywhere. There's people on oxygen tanks and hallways.
So, of course, there are lots of ventilators involved.
Yes, lots of ventilators, lots of BiPAP, CPAP, intubating. It's almost like an assembly line. Like, you're almost numb to it because you're already going into the situation expecting them to die. Every 5 minutes, there was rapid response.
What's rapid response mean in an emergency room?
A rapid response is somebody clinically has deteriorated and you want the whole team to come there to try to save this patient. They're coming down body bag and taking them away.
It's become a really common sight here in New York to see makeshift morgues outside the hospitals.
There was trailers outside with body bags in them because the morgue was overflowed.
How does a typical workday start for you these days? How do you cope with what's ahead?
Park your car and then you just sit in your car for a couple of minutes and just try to clear your head as much as possible because you know you're going into something. As much as you want to try to save people, a lot of them are going to die. You're going to have multiple deaths on your conscience every day. Go into the room, get report, try to look at the patients, their records and see their notes and see what's going on. And then you gown up, mask, eyewear, shields, sonnets, everything. Try to keep yourself covered as much as possible and you start your day.
That sounds really scary.
It's very scary. I actually have an autoimmune ailment and I could end up being one of these patients in a bed, but I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. I love helping. And if I go out helping somebody, then it is what it is. But I'm always scared because I have parents at home. I have kids at home.
How old are your kids?
I have a 10-year-old daughter and a 5-year-old son.
How are they doing with all this?
My daughter, she kind of watches the news, and so she knows what's going on and what I'm doing. So she's always a little on the anxious side, but we talk every day. We text all the time. I send her pictures and try to reassure her, and she know I'll drop everything and come back home to her.
And your young son?
My son just thinks I'm a superhero. He's just like, that's really just how he sees it.
That's how I see it too, actually.
Oh, thank you.
Is all this what you signed up for when you trained to become a respiratory therapist?
Yes, but the one thing that we didn't sign up for was not having enough equipment and not having enough PPE. That's what we didn't sign up for. Like the mask, you get one for the week and you're reusing it for days on end. It's not fair that we don't have the proper tools to make sure we're safe ourselves.
Because of how contagious COVID is, people mostly die alone in these hospitals or with only one family member present at most. You told me about one of your typical experiences comforting a woman whose mother had just suddenly died.
Yes, she was just walking down the hallway. I'm coming back from whatever floor I was on, and she just broke down crying in the hallway by herself. Can't have any of her support system. Her mom just died, And of course, I'm in my little mini hazmat suit, and I'm like, I can't really touch her, but she really needs a hug. And I took my hazmat suit off and took all my equipment off, and I just gave her a hug and let her cry on my shoulder. And then she said she felt better, and she went her way. I put everything back on, and I went my way.
Sydney Van Ness is a traveling respiratory therapist who now works in the crisis response unit of a major New York hospital. She was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. And coming up later.
So far, it looks like it has the capacity to spread through populations. And if we can find a way to help it get a foothold, get a head start, it might be possible to get populations up to the level where the mosquitoes are no longer posing any risk to us.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The World Health Organization says by 2050, 10 million people throughout the world could die each year from diseases that are resistant to antibiotics. As microbes continue to develop mutations and render previously effective medications useless, scientists are developing new methods of treatment to fight these so-called superbugs. Researchers from Canada's McMaster University say they have found from their experiments with mice that a new group of antibiotics called glycopeptides can kill bacteria in a new and unique way. They say the new drugs can stop functions that are necessary for bacterial cells to divide and multiply. The researchers found that these new antibiotics can block infections caused by the drug-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, a group of microbes that can cause a number of serious diseases, including pneumonia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The United States Congress has been a flurry of activity as of late as it deals with issues of investigation and oversight. Now, to break things down on these high-profile happenings, I spoke earlier with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. I began our conversation by asking her for the latest on Congress's efforts to find out why U.S. President Donald Trump wants to fire another inspector general.
Right. Well, one of the most important revelations happened earlier this week when House Foreign Affairs Chairman Elliot Engel said that his committee was looking into the possibility that the IG was examining Pompeo for misdeeds related to the Saudi arms sale that happened last year. He mentioned that, you know, initial media reports had been that Pompeo was being investigated because he had misused State Department staff for a personal errand. But as we're getting more information about the IG firing, it appears that the scope of that is much wider. We're also hearing that Pompeo was having dinners on the State Department's dime. He's due to talk about that this week and address those reports. But definitely what we're going to be seeing from Capitol Hill from the Democratic majority-controlled U.S. House is that they're going to be looking further into this IG removal.
That's over on the U.S. House where the Democrats do have control. But over on the Senate side where Republicans have control, there's been some movement on several committees. So let's start things off with the judiciary hearing and its chair, Lindsey Graham.
Right. So Lindsey Graham is looking into this issue of what President Trump calls Obamagate, which is a series of mostly unspecified allegations against the former president relating to what he calls the unmasking of officials. Now, a lot of what people are pointing out right now is that that process is actually routine for intelligence services and for high-ranking U.S. officials. That said, the Republican majority U.S. House, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on Tuesday, said that they would be issuing subpoenas to look further into this issue and that they would be digging down into what the president says is President Obama's misuse of the U.S. government.
As I understand it as well, there's also a mechanism in place for when a request is made by administration officials to so-called unmask Americans in intelligence operations, that process was followed in this instance.
Absolutely. And there's been an email released from Susan Rice, a former Obama administration official, who actually emailed herself on the day of President Trump's inauguration, noting that President Obama had given strict instructions to follow all of these procedures by the book, according to U.S. government rules and standards, and that nothing illegal had happened, that they were basically following what were routine procedures.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga went before investigative judges today in Paris, France. The purpose of the meeting was to decide whether he should be handed over to a UN court handling cases of crimes against humanity. Now, to get the details on the proceedings, I spoke with journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris via WhatsApp.
Well, basically, right now, the lawyers, they're going to ask for a postponement of the procedure because basically they want to have time. The argument for them is to say that because he was arrested on a Saturday, it's a so short notice for them to prepare the defense ahead of the trial that they need at least a week to be able to prepare the defense and make sure that Kabuga has the best defense team, everything ready before the decision. And right now, French authorities and the French judicial system, they have to decide whether Kabuga can be extradited to The Hague to face the International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals. It's kind of similar to the ICC. It's not exactly that, because you know the International Court for Rwanda was over in Arusha over the past few years. So he will be trialed if he's extradited to an international mechanism system.
Now, it looks like that hearing is going to take place on May 27th, according to the latest reports out of France. How was Kabuga when he was in the proceedings?
Well, and I think that's the most important because this is the first time we had a glimpse at Kabuga. over the past 26 years. So he was in a wheelchair, kind of weak, you know, he's supposed to be 84 years old. But, you know, he was alert, he was talking and waving to one of his family member present in the courtroom. He gave his date of birth, which according to him is March 1st, 1933. He was kind of weak with his voice. He was in blue jeans, but you can hear him pretty well. And I think we can now assert it for sure that he is Mr. Kabuga, the fugitive, one of the top three fugitives that has been, you know, searched for so many years by the authorities.
Nico, have we learned any additional details about how Kabuga was captured?
Yes, because French intelligence agents, they really talk about how they tracked Kabuga and his whereabouts in this city very close to Paris. And one of them talked today in the court. His name is Eric Emro. He's the head of the Central Office for Combating Crimes Against Humanity of the French military police, which is called the Gendarmerie. And basically, he mentioned that because of the slowdown and because of the lockdown that happened in Europe, he had so many cases that because of the lockdown, he was able to work on fewer cases. And one of them was the whereabouts of Mr. Kabuga. So then that's really because of his children, because they were tracking, you know, his children, their activities. And basically, almost all of them, they were getting around this city near Paris, which is Agnières. And so little by little, they circle a place, an apartment where they think he would have been. And so they wiretap the property. They really install a surveillance. And, you know, as soon as they had a strong belief that he was inside, they made a move.
Nicolas Pinault is a reporter based in Paris, France. It is a disease that kills hundreds of thousands of people around the world every year. A team of scientists have discovered that a microbe called a microsporidia can prevent mosquitoes from being infected with Plasmodium, the parasite that actually causes malaria. Reuters' Olivia Chan has that story.
Diana Aloche is mourning the death of her 11-month-old daughter, Mary Umu. The baby died in Kenya's Kisumu province in March, one of the hundreds of thousands of people each year killed by malaria. But less than 200 miles away in the capital, Nairobi, a team of scientists have discovered what they think could be a vital tool against the mosquito-borne disease. It's a microbe called Microsporidia that can stop mosquitoes from infected with the parasite that causes malaria. Here's Jeremy Heron of the International Centre of Insect Physiology and Ecology in Nairobi and Lake Victoria.
We found that it's transmitted from mother mosquitoes to their offspring. So once a mosquito population is infected, the next generation of mosquitoes coming through will also be infected.
There is increasing evidence that resistance is growing to commonly used anti-malarial drugs. And in places like Kisumu, many families cannot afford bed nets or insecticide, meaning children, who are often the victims of malaria, can get affected several times a month.
In a month, I go to the hospital maybe three times, sometimes with all of the kids. When one of them gets healed, then the other gets sick.
There are many breeding sites in this region of Kenya, and it's here where the science team aims to release mosquitoes infected with the microbe into the wild.
The next stage in terms of getting it out there is going to require us to better understand its transmission biology, but so far it looks like it has the capacity to spread through populations, and if we can find a way to help it get a foothold, get a head start, it might be possible to get populations up to the level where the mosquitoes are no longer posing any risk to us.
And that could mean fewer mothers like Diana living with the heartache of a lost child.
That was Reuters' Olivia Chan. Mokhetsi Majuro was sworn in as Lesotho's new prime minister Wednesday, a day after his predecessor resigned under pressure over a scandal involving the murder of his wife. Maduro, who was previously the country's finance minister, took the oath at the King's Palace in front of dignitaries. He will stay in charge until scheduled elections in June of 2022. It was only the third time that power has changed hands peacefully in Lesotho's history since independence from Britain in 1966, a period marked by coups and waves of unrest. The Iranian Navy will maintain regular missions in the Gulf, according to the ISNA news agency, a day after the United States warned mariners there to stay away from U.S. warships. The United States warning to mariners followed U.S. President Donald Trump's threat last month to fire on any Iranian ships that harass U.S. Navy vessels. It follows an incident last month in which 11 Iranian vessels came close to U.S. Navy and Coast Guard ships in the Gulf in what the U.S. military called dangerous and provocative behavior. Tehran blamed its longtime adversary for the incident. The move came as the U.S. Treasury announced new sanctions on its website. Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen vowed Wednesday to step up defense following a series of bigger-than-normal threats by her government's longtime rival China. Reuters' Gloria So has the details.
Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen was sworn in for her second and final term on Wednesday, making her message loud and clear that Taiwan strongly rejects China's claims of sovereignty over the island.
Both sides have a duty to find a way to coexist over the long term and prevent the intensification of antagonism and differences. I also expect the leader of the other side, China, to take up equal responsibility to stabilize the long-term development of cross-strait relations together.
In her speech at Taipei's presidential palace, Tsai said Taiwan could not accept becoming part of China under its one-country, two-systems offer, which is supposed to guarantee autonomy. But Tsai called for talks with China so that both sides could coexist. Tsai led Taiwan's Democratic Progressive Party to a landslide victory in January, vowing to stand up to China. Recently, Taiwan has also accused China of keeping it out of the World Health Organization. And during her speech, Tsai said Taiwan would continue seeking active participation in international bodies.
Over the next 4 years, we will continue to fight for our participation in international organizations, strengthen mutually beneficial cooperation with our allies, and bolster ties with the United States, Japan, Europe, and other like-minded countries.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo congratulated Tsai on Tuesday, praising her, quote, courage and vision in leading Taiwan's vibrant democracy. Meanwhile, China's Taiwan Affairs Office said on Wednesday that China would not tolerate any talks about Taiwan's independence.
Gloria So reports for Reuters News. Heavy rains and winds lashed two eastern Indian states of Odisha and West Bengal hours before a powerful cyclone made landfall on Wednesday. Rescue teams were evacuating millions of villagers to higher ground in an operation complicated by the coronavirus pandemic. PK Jenna is with the Special Relief Commission in Odisha.
We have shifted, evacuated about little more than 1,37,000 people, and still evacuation is going on in certain pockets of Baleswar and Mayurbhanj district, where people are so much coming to our cyclone shelter after looking at the rain and the wind. People are coming.
Extra shelters are being prepared in wholesale markets and government buildings with allowances made for social distancing, while masks and scarves are being distributed among the villagers. In Bangladesh, authorities have moved hundreds of Rohingya refugees living on a flood-prone island in the Bay of Bengal to storm shelters. The United Nations has called for the refugees to be moved to the mainland to join more than a million more who are living in sprawling camps outside the town of Cox's Bazar. Although the settlement, the world's largest refugee camp, is expected to escape the worst of the storm, the danger level there has been raised to 9 from 6, signifying a severe threat. At least one 70-year-old man was killed by a falling tree in Bangladesh's coastal Bola district. The low-lying country has evacuated 2.4 million people to shelters. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.